I'm Brian Earle, and this is Bug Bites, part of the Zesty Garden. And in studio with me today is Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist. And Diane, looking at a couple of articles from entomology today, they're both dealing with mosquitoes. And actually, I see quite a few articles about mosquitoes. Why are mosquitoes so studied?
Well, as you well know, that mosquitoes vector some pretty nasty diseases, and that's one of the big reasons why they are one of the major targets for control to improve health in what has been mostly third world or certainly developing kinds of countries. But it's interesting that you point out these two articles that we're going to talk about here. A lot of the work now is being done in Florida, Puerto Rico, places that we don't think of as necessarily, you know, being those remote third world world countries. It's places that are right here in the U.S. and are having some challenges with mosquito vector diseases.
Well, let's talk about this first article. Mosquitoes are relying on roads to disperse. What?
Isn't that interesting? And so the point being made here, especially in more tropical areas where this Asian tiger mosquito is native to, that by building a large roadway network, you're actually helping the mosquitoes facilitate getting around faster and better.
Why don't they just fly directly?
Well, they have to fly up over the canopy of the trees, which may be higher than they like to fly. They put them into danger of being preyed upon by birds or other predators. So they often want to stay down in a more cryptic, moist, modified environment rather than being up above in the sunlight. And so sticking to roadways, but probably along the edges, taking advantage of cover along the edges is a great way for them to get around.
Well, one of the things that they talked about to stem the mosquito spread was to order authorities to fumigate vehicles at checkpoints. Now,
yes.
This is in Panama.
Right.
I wouldn't want my vehicle fumigated.
Fumigated? I wouldn't either, but I guess they're, you know, in a place where they're trying to prevent this particular mosquito and the diseases it carries from moving into new areas where it hasn't been before. That is one of the ways that they've found to be effective.
Okay, so let's talk about the mosquitoes themselves and the diseases they transmit and what we're doing to try to stem the tide. And I find this interesting because I heard something on NPR yesterday about how the genetics of a male mosquito are being changed, basically to make it sterile. They still mate with the females, but the offspring are not viable.
Right.
So the way some headlines are being written, though, it's sensationalizing it and making it sound worse than it really is.
Right. Well, they're calling them genetically modified mosquitoes. And so when an average person might hear that, especially in a sensationalized news story. What might you think that could mean? A genetically modified mosquito? I would probably feel a little worried, a little scared.
Frankensquito,
yeah,
you know?
Exactly. What's this mosquito going to be like? Is it going to be huge? Is it going to be able to bite me, you know, more times? Is it going to be able to take in a larger blood meal? You know, what are the features that they have changed? And so that just in itself can be sensationalized and make it sound as if it's something negative.
But they don't give all of the information. You just immediately go to your worst fears sometimes.
Exactly. So. But they have been working with genetically modified mosquitoes for many decades now to try to develop some more unique, non-pesticidal, long-lasting, effective control methods so that they can help reduce mosquito populations, reduce the likelihood of them vectoring these nasty diseases to people in places where they're a real problem. So it's actually a very positive thing, not a negative thing.
What was it in the 1950s?
Right.
The screw worm.
Right.
It's been eliminated.
Right.
In 1982. That's what it says here in the article. And I had no idea that was even going on.
Right. So that's a different kind of, it's a fly, but a different kind of fly. And that was an effort that was started. One of the earlier kind of large scale USDA funded projects to address this very devastating pest of cattle. and other kinds of livestock, especially in the southern United States, where the screwworm was a common problem that would actually, as the name sounds, kind of drill into the hide, to the back, the sides of livestock. And when they'd get enough of them on them, it would greatly lower the productivity of the livestock and could even kill them in some cases. And so those early techniques, they used this method called the sterile insect technique. And the idea was that if we can basically overwhelm the wild population, in this case it was the screwworm fly, with these sterilized male screwworm flies, all of the wild females will soon be breeding, or most of them, with these radiated male flies, which are sterile, and they won't result in viable offspring, thus reducing the population of the screwworm over time. And this is exactly what happened, and it has proven to be a tremendously effective approach to eradicating a very pestiferous insect. There are some challenges, though, with radiation. You have to have large-scale facilities to do this. You have to, of course, grow the insects in, you know, an insectary type of facility, and then you have to have these large-scale irradiation types of chambers to treat the insects. And so all of those come with costs and some challenges to them. But then another real downside is these radiated insects don't tend to perform as well. They tend to not be quite as healthy as a wild screwworm fly or mosquito. And so the downside of that then is that they're not doing as good of a job getting out there in the environment and locating these wild females and mating with them. And so you're not getting quite as good of success. And so this new technique that the article is talking about is now going to more modifying the DNA and creating some lethal genes so that when the offspring come along, they're not viable. So the mating is unsuccessful, and getting away from the radiation.
And apparently, it's been done in olive flies in Europe, and to the Mediterranean fruit fly. It says here mosquitoes were previously released in Panama and Brazil, where they achieved a 96% suppression of the dengue mosquito.
Yes, yeah,
that's phenomenal.
That's very impressive.
So what are the downsides to this?
Well, on the surface, it would seem that there aren't any. But I thought one little interesting point that one of the articles pointed out was that when you do alter the population size of one mosquito or one, in this case, a mosquito that's in has a niche to fill, that is the way it makes its living in an area, it can have impacts on other mosquitoes that share that niche or have overlaps with that same niche. And they saw that. So with this yellow fever carrying mosquito, the Aedes aegypti that they had used the genetically modified sterile insect release for, they then saw an increase in populations of the Asian tiger mosquito, which also is a vector of different diseases. This chikungunya you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. That's an interesting name. and although not as devastating of a disease as yellow fever or dengue, it still is a concern, and we don't want more of those Asian tiger mosquitoes around.
And now they're starting to show up in Florida.
Right.
And so now all of a sudden a certain amount of the population has been concerned about it, but now that it's hit the U.S., all of a sudden, oh, it's in my backyard. And
right.
So now people are getting concerned about it. And to look at some of the way that the press, and I work in the press, but to see some of these headlines and how the articles are written is just completely crazy. The Daily Free Press, I'm not even sure where it is. They don't say where that newspaper is. It says that the mutant mosquitoes somehow vaccinate people with their bites, and which could be good in other parts of the other world. Well, that doesn't vaccinate people.
Right. So they have some interesting takes. And so it's important.
And
the males don't
bite people.
Right.
It's
the males
the
don't bite. It's only so the ones they're releasing aren't even going to be biting people at all.
Yeah.
So that's a good point. So I think it's a good, you know, as I know that it's a policy here at UPR to practice ethical and good quality news broadcasting, and I think that's unfortunately not all media outlets have that same credo, but I think that it would be important to make sure you get the right information out there.
There's always this part of me that says, well, when you tinker with nature, do you really know what your end result is going to be? Because you could, on the surface, it looks like, oh, this is going to be a really great thing, but there could be an unintended consequence.
Yes.
But in this case, we kind of know what's happening because we've used it in the past.
Well, we have, but you still make a good point. You need to proceed with caution. You need to start small, do small scale tests, see what the results are, and not just ramp it up too quickly, because there are often these unforeseen. Even these scientists didn't foresee that where they lowered the populations of the yellow fever carrying mosquito, that they were going to be potentially increasing this Asian tiger mosquito. So, that was
lowering one disease and increasing another.
So I think you do have to still proceed with, we know we have to proceed with caution.
I love the success stories though. And I'm thinking of the tamarisk beetle, mm-hmm. and how it feeds only on tamarisk. And I'm like, let them all go so we can get rid of tamarisk, because mm-hmm. it's such a choking weed of our waterways. But proceeding with caution is always the best.
It is. And the tamarisk beetle example, it does work well, but it doesn't work overnight. You have to still have patience too.
I don't have patience. I want it right now. Diane, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
You've been listening to Bug Bites. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. And we'll have her back in again. Thanks, Diane.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Going Native segment of the Zesty Garden. Barney Barnett is in studio with me, and he's co-owner of Willard Bay Gardens in Willard. And Barney, this next one is Nepeta or Nepeta, and to be quite frank, I'm surprised it's on the list, because I usually try to avoid mint because it just likes to go to town. So why is this on your list?
Well, this plant, Nepeta, Nepeta, cat mint is the common name, not catnip. Catnip is a different species of, it's this genus, but it's, anyway. This plant blooms April, May, into June, and again, August, September. It forms a lovely gray-green mound, and if you will seclude it or put it in a drier garden, doesn't cause you any grief. Whereas if it's in a wetter spot, more organic spot, a little bit nicer spot in the garden,
that's where it goes woohoo and takes off.
That is exactly right. This plant will establish at some point and be water free as far as you're concerned. I mean, you can be completely drought tolerant or completely xeric. You can have it in a garden that gets water, but then you have to watch out.
So it spreads from seed as well as underground?
It's primarily a reseeder as far as extra plants. And you'll find oodles of seedlings in and around the mother plant, so to speak, if it's in a moisture garden, because those seeds will germinate. But if it's in a drier garden, then the seeds won't germinate. And so it will ramble. It's mounding and rambling, but most of the excess plants that you would have in the garden is going to be from seeding.
So full sun?
Full sun.
And you would have this in a dry spot?
Have it in a dry spot, yeah.
And how tall does it get?
There's a bunch of different cultivars or forms. The straight species typically will be 15 or 18 inches tall and 18 to 24 inches wide. So that's the typical species. But there's all kinds of new cultivars. Cultivars are plants that are selections or genetic mutations of a plant that have come about in the last few years that are tidier. There's one called Little Titch that's 6 or 8 inches tall and 15 inches across. There's some new ones like Persian Blue, P-U-R-R.
Oh, no.
And The Cat's Meow, and similar silly names like that the breeders or the people who've selected these plants have tried to get the public's attention by doing something related to catmint. Anyway, there are some new cultivars that are tidier. So you can find some that might be 15 or 18 inches tall and 15 or 18 inches wide, or 12 or 15 inches tall and 15 or 18 inches wide. So some tidier forms, more compact forms, that would be less likely to get out of bounds. But it blooms twice, and it blooms blue-purple, and it's got fragrant foliage, and it performs well in a dry garden, so that's why it's on my list.
So the reason it gets a bad reputation is that a lot of us have just happened to have them in an area where it's going to town on its own.
That's right.
And we just need to put it in somewhere it does not get any extra care whatsoever.
Right. Put in less water. I've got a neighbor in South Willard that has, I suspect, we put in 30 plants maybe 10 or 12 years ago on a dry gravelly hillside, and they watered it the first summer, and now they do nothing to it, and they just let it go. They don't even do anything at all,
and it just stays green and does just fine on its own.
Yeah, big gravelly hillside.
So the ones that I have, I have no idea if it's cat mint, and that they've always been there since I moved in, and they're always on the periphery of the property, and they'll get 3 feet tall. Is this the same?
Is it mounding or is it upright?
It's upright.
So you might have a different species than the cat mint, so to speak, because Nepeta has several species, including catnip. So you may have a different, if it's upright, because the ones I'm talking about, even the ones that get tall, still have a mounding habit.
Yeah, these definitely aren't mounding. Okay, well, this is one that I'll consider to put into my flower bed between my driveway and the neighbor's driveway, where I just don't want to do anything.
Very good.
So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Brian.
You've been listening to the Going Native segment of The Zesty Garden. Barney Barnett, co-owner of Willard Bay Gardens in Willard, has been in studio, and we've been talking about Nepeta, or Nepeta, also known as catmint. Bench, she is the spokesperson for the Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers, and they just had a way-off. And da-da-da-da, Lindsay, tell me what happened.
Oh, it was fantastic. It was so much fun. And this year, we even had sun instead of rain. Last year, it was freezing.
And so
we have a winner.
You have a winner. And so last year, the winner, the winning pumpkin weighed how much?
Last year, the winning pumpkin at the weigh-off at Thanksgiving Point was 1731, but the state record ended up being 1817.
And that was the year before, wasn't it?
It was actually last year. It was weighed in a different state, but it was from Utah, so it still counted up as the Utah state record.
Oh, okay. And so what happened this year?
This year, the winning pumpkin weighed 1455, so 1,455 pounds, and the winner was Brent Evans.
And has Brent won before?
He has not, so that was kind of exciting. It was a new winner, and he also has a son that grows as well. So, and his son had a personal best. It was kind of a fun way off because a lot of people had pumpkins that were their best, their personal bests that were bigger than they've ever grown, and it was just, you know, we had new faces get different prizes, and it was fun.
And that's always a good thing because it brings more people in to the group, and you start hooking them in, and they just find out how fun it is.
Yes, of course.
So, all right, so we're talking like a 300-pound difference from the state record to this year. Is that what happens when you have a month of rainy, cool weather?
You know, last year, you know what, I don't know. I don't know if it's just the dude. His name's Matt McConkey, and I don't know if he has, like, some secret magic soil or if he, like, feeds his pumpkins steroids, what he does. But he grows huge pumpkins, and I don't know if, I mean, he grows in greenhouses, and I'm sure that has, you know, where he has, like, a controlled environment, controlled watering, controlled everything, and he just knows what he's doing.
So tell me about the way off then. That was the end of September, and you have another way off coming up?
Yes, the way off was the 26th, and it was at Thanksgiving Point, and I'm not sure how many entries there were, many, many. There's a junior division and then the main division, and they just start weighing the pumpkins from estimated smallest to largest. And mine was a personal best. Previously, my pumpkin, my best, was 307 pounds. And mine ended up weighing 755 pounds.
So that's got to feel pretty good. You more than doubled the weight.
Yeah, it was great. Although I really wanted to break a half ton. That's for next year, I guess.
And so what?
Then I can be part of the, you know, quote, half ton club, and that's cool.
What do you think you'll do different next year?
You know, if I'm going to stay in my house longer, I'm going to chop down a tree, maybe.
you're a little short on sunlight?
I am. I'm short on sunlight. I don't get sun until about 1:30 in the afternoon. So I think that would help a lot, and I would get my watering system in earlier so that it's steady throughout the whole season.
And tell me about what is coming up. There's another way off this weekend.
Yes. So this is new this year, the first annual way off at Hee-Haw Farm, which is in Pleasant Grove. And it is on the 10th of October.
So there possibly could still be another record breaker lurking out there that just didn't get weighed?
Yes. In fact, anything that's been grown in Utah, whether it's weighed here or elsewhere, can count, you know, as a state record here.
So, and apparently you're weighing more than pumpkins.
Yes. We, you know, we're the Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers, and we grow giant pumpkins, but people bring giant vegetables, giant tomatoes. They're weighing. They have giant pear gourds, giant zucchini or marrows, they call them, and it's a blast.
This is fairly traditional too, because I was watching a series on PBS, and as part of that series, they were talking about growing giant potatoes. Who could get the largest potato?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and if you go on our Facebook page, the Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers, you know, we're all kind of involved a little bit in that. People will post pictures of their giant radishes or their giant whatever it is that they grow. It's a lot of fun.
Do you grow
giant? Bring us together, and it's a lot of fun to watch each other and what each other are growing. We share seeds.
Do you grow giant broccoli?
I have not seen that.
Maybe that's something I'll have to bring down.
Maybe we just cut down our tree and send that in. I don't know.
Well, overall, how would you grade this season for yourself and then also for the giant pumpkin growers?
You know, we had so many pumpkins lost this year. I think they would say it was kind of a crazy season. For me personally, it was good. I got a personal best. The weather was definitely up and down and all around, but it was just fun to see different people rise and bring bigger pumpkins, and, you know, the old winners and the people who usually bring the bigger ones just come and support everyone. And it was just a lot of fun to see new faces win.
Well, I'm curious, how do you move a giant pumpkin? So you had your 300-pounder last year. Now you've got a 700-pounder, and I mean, you've got an elaborate system to feed it and to water it. How do you move it?
This is good. I'm glad you asked. So it took a lot of thought, actually, because it's not easy to get any kind of moving vehicle into my backyard. We have a hill into our backyard, and it's not big. So I thought on this one, and what I came up with was to screw my old skis onto the bottom of a pallet, and we got as many people as we could in the neighborhood and slipped a kind of like a lifting tarp underneath the pumpkin best we could by kind of tipping it. And then we all took pieces of it and lifted it just enough to get on top of it. And, you know, really, we, all of us, were just lifting. We could barely get about 6 inches up to get on top of the pallet. And once we got it on the pallet, we skied it on out. We pulled it with a Ranger, as well as we had to push it as well. We pulled it with the Ranger, and then the rest of us pushed it. We got it up the hill, and then did the same on, up onto a trailer.
I was just wondering if you had like a winch on a truck that would, you know, winch it toward the truck, and then I just can imagine this could be a real neighborhood job. How many people were there?
Oh yeah, harvest day is a big deal. You know, it's, you know, who's gonna help and how are you gonna do it? And you know, I ended up having the skis on the bottom of a pallet, which was hilarious to my dad, but ended up working fantastic. And then other people, yeah, they'll use winches. Another friend used scaffolding. Some people use lifting rings or tripods. My dad used a forklift. So
your dad,
however creative way you can get, you know, however you can do it without cracking or injuring the pumpkin, because if, you know, if it's cracked, if there's holes, then it's disqualified. So it's, you know, there's a lot of nerves involved.
Your dad shouldn't be laughing at you. He's the one that got you involved with this. You used to laugh at him.
Right? You laughed, but my idea worked.
so tell me about the judging process itself. It's not just how much it weighs. What else are they looking at?
Well, the main weigh off prize is just the weight. Which one weighs the most and doesn't have cracks, is sound, doesn't have bruises, doesn't have pieces out of it. If it's damaged, then they can't. It's not qualified. There is a Howard Dill Award where it's the prettiest pumpkin. Which one looks the best?
Well, and how do you, with all that moving though, I can't imagine you not having a few little divots in there. I mean, do they give you some leeway?
Yeah. If it's scratched or damaged a little bit, that's fine. But it can't. I mean, there are definite rules that are defined in the GPC. You know, there are written rules that have to apply. Like it can't have holes or anything where people could stick stuff in to make it weigh more. If it has a crack, you know, that's why we ended up blowing that one up, because it had cracked open.
So you had a big one
like that.
You had a big one that couldn't be judged because it had a crack in it, and so you blew it up?
Yes. It had a crack. It grew too fast, and the skin cracked on it, so into the cavity. So we put a Tupperware of Tannerite inside it and blew the pumpkin up.
So tell me about this pumpkin blowing up. I guess last year it was a private affair, but this year you made it more public?
Yes, and we want to do it next year and make it even more public.
So what do
you... We're always thinking of crazy things to do. We've floated one of these huge pumpkins down the Colorado River as well.
I was just going to ask, what do you do with these giant pumpkins once they've been weighed off?
Well, there's the regatta coming up on the 17th, and that's the boat race, Sugar House Park. And then following that on the 24th is the pumpkin drop, where we're going to smash things and have all kinds of mess. Smash cars, pianos, whatever we can find.
Who donates the things to be smashed?
Anyone that has anything they want to donate. If anyone has anything they'd like to donate, please contact us.
I think I saw last year you dropped a pumpkin on a van.
We did.
That was...
We tried to do a catapult. That didn't quite work out, but we've dropped cars on pumpkins. We dropped pumpkins on cars, dropped them on trailers.
So the regatta
cannons.
The regatta is on the 17th.
Yes,
and
correct.
Where is that held?
Sugar House.
And what time?
Sugar House Pond, from 10 to 2, I believe.
Okay, and when is the drop?
The drop is at Hee Haw Farms, and it is on the 24th. And it is usually from 12 to 4. I'll have to check the time on that for sure.
But if anyone had any questions or wanted to get more information, they would just go to UtahGiantPumpkinGrowers.org or .com?
.com.
Okay. And that'll have all the information.
Events coming up.
Plus, you'll be able to find videos of stuff, I'm sure.
All of the fun stuff that we've done and are doing. And if you're interested in seeing you know, what the regatta is like or what the drop is like, you can check those out. They're just a lot of fun.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, join the club. Get some seeds. I promise you, once you try this once, you'll be hooked.
And
it seems funny. I made fun of this one time.
And where do you get the seed?
From us. From joining the club, you get a packet of seeds.
And what does it cost to join the club, and you just do that through the website?
Yeah, you can do that on the website or at our events. You can get more information as well. And I believe it's $20, and you get a packet of all of the best genetics in the state. So
sounds like fun. I know it's pretty detailed. We've been following you all through the summer, and it's been kind of fascinating listening to all the things you've been doing for your own pumpkin. And congratulations on how much more larger you're able to grow a pumpkin this year.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun. It really is.
That's Lindsay Bent. She is the spokesperson for the Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers, and we've been following her all through the summer. And hopefully you can head down and go to the pumpkin drop or the pumpkin regatta. Information is at UtahGiantPumpkinGrowers.com. Lindsay, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
We danced so hard to the Chambers Brothers' Psychedelic Soul, I broke the heel off one black suede boot and threw the other one under the couch. Sally got blisters on her heels from dancing so long without stockings in Fry boots. And when two police officers came to the front and the back doors to break up the party, Sally and I limped into the park, smoked Marlboro Reds until everyone had drifted out of the girls' house, and doubled back so that we could drive home in my parents' Dodge Dart. It had some dead animal stuck in the carburetor. My father was a city boy and believed that cars, like subways, ran reliably without intervention. We drove all winter with the windows down and our hands over our noses. Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams, and I'm going to finish reading this humorous essay called Cooking and Stealing, written by Amy Bloom and published in a book by the same name as her essay, Cooking and Stealing. It's the Tin House Nonfiction Reader. And it ends, of course, with some yummy recipes, which I will want to share with you. But we'll get back to Amy's account of this lovely little time of her life when we may all have been there after high school and coming into college, late teens, early 20s. So she continues, "We were best friends from the moment we met. I thought her batik halter tops were sexy, as she hoped, and that her wide hips and short white hands were beautiful, and that her motorcycle riding boyfriend was glamorous. So glamorous, she locked me in the girls' room when he rode up after school because she thought I couldn't be trusted. And I don't say that she was wrong back then. Until I found him out, as weak and vain and helplessly cruel as Vronsky. She couldn't leave him, she said. She did, of course, before the year was over. She was dating a boy who was all not glamour, tortoiseshell frames and big ears, and no transportation at all. But he was sweet and yielding, incapable of standing her up or holding a lighter so close it singed the tiny blonde hairs on her smooth hands. But my job was to help her stay away from Mr. Motorcycle until she could. My job, as the better armored person, was to keep us out from under the people who made her feel bad, such as her peculiar parents, her smug and blank siblings, her conniving psychiatrists. Sally's job was to socialize me, to bring me in from the jungle. And when she got me tottering along socially, she taught me how to be a friend, through the usual approach of endless intimate conversation and the happy development of our mutual interests, stealing and cooking. Sally was a great shoplifter and a great cook, and when we weren't stealing stuff to wear, we stole stuff to cook. Sometimes, when she was intent on making something, we even bought the ingredients. When we became mothers and wives later, she became an even better cook and an upright person. And when she told me how she made her little boy bring back the chocolate bar he'd taken from the store, she didn't even wink. She stole a beautiful black bathing suit for me from under the noses of the discerning sales ladies at Saks Fifth Avenue, and she stole a James Beard cookbook because she admired him. In the midst of chaos, her psychiatrist father was as crazy in his way as her artistic mother was in hers, Sally cooked to create order and pleasure. We cooked as privately, as discreetly as possible, as if we were not engaging in the most shocking perversities. The wish not to be seen cooking by our mothers was enormous and pressing. Sally didn't want her mother, the love child of Edgar Allan Poe and Martha Stewart, if they had left the foundling to be raised by Iggy Pop, interfering and suggesting and turning our pleasure into some ghastly exercise in bonding that might end in our helping her make her astounding Hieronymus Bosch hooked rugs. Sally didn't want her father complimenting us on our newfound femininity. Her parents scared the crap out of me, and since my relationship with them consisted of my screeching around the corner at midnight as Sally leaped into my car in her nightgown and her mother hurled crockery at her and then at us, I tried to get in and out of her house invisibly. This once required me to hide under Sally's bed for an hour and a half while her mother talked to her about birth control. I didn't want my mother to see me doing anything ever, and since cooking in our house was largely a matter of defrosting the Stouffer's, the whole enterprise would have excited a lot of unwanted attention. But we cooked when no one was home. In particular, we fried. And when all that hot oil was too much and the spring leaves had started to unfurl, we made light and creamy things. I have not included among the recipes here her amazing chicken salad, nor our 6 different versions of Pim's cup, which we drank in our backyards while putting iodine and baby oil on our legs for a quicker tan. Sally was already sick even when we were dancing to the Chambers Brothers, even when we wore our bathing suits to Jones Beach and let boys buy us French fries. By the time she was in college and out and then back in and waitressing and clerking in bookstores, she had a brain tumor. Not trouble concentrating, as her mother said, not a hysterical symptom, as her father said, but a benign brain tumor that she would have removed many times and that grew back each time even more resilient, even more tenacious than Sally was. She married a good man and had surgery. She had her beautiful baby boy and had surgery. She became a master teacher and had a couple of brain surgeries along the way. She cooked anyway. She cooked even when she became a high-wire act, and even when her sense of smell deserted her. I carried mint leaves and coffee beans into the ICU because their scent reached her. Everything reached her, and she never stopped grabbing it, sniffing it, running her tongue over it, even in memory. As she was dying, nurses and doctors crowded into her room just to be with her funny, kind, insistent self. She made me mind my manners with nurses who were not what I thought they should be, and she made me be generous with her time, as she was. She made jokes with her keyboard when she couldn't speak. She critiqued my work and dictated the most loving letters to her friends and family, key by key. Before her final surgery, we took our children out to Sardi's, which we had hoped would be nostalgic and glorious, and which was neither. Unhappy waiters served us terrible food. Sally, who hated to waste money and hated to make a scene, gathered everybody up and, the effects of her last 3 strokes notwithstanding, flung her coat on as best she could, shook her head in reproach at the maitre d', and led us out. We came out on the street in front of 2 food carts, and after Hebrew National hot dogs for lunch, we walked uptown slowly for hot fudge sundaes. "Never eat bad food," she said. "It's not just bad. It's wrong." Every few days we got together at someone's house, someone whose parents were both at work, and people who liked to get stoned, and the 2 guys who liked to take acid took acid, and Sally and I, who got sleepy when we smoked pot and were terrified of acid, made apple or peach or tropical fritters. It probably takes 45 minutes to make these, and we sometimes did it in half that time when people were desperate, and sometimes in twice that time, depending on how many people were helping and what condition they were in. Back in that day, Sally and I sometimes chased these with shots of rum. Later, when the acid heads had become a beekeeper and a stockbroker, respectively, and all of the potheads had become what you'd expect, ophthalmologists, journalists, judges, mothers and fathers, Sally and I still cooked these for ourselves, for neighborhood brunches, and for our little kids who loved them, if you managed to remind them, in time, not to burn the roofs of their mouths on the hot fruit. Here is a recipe for tropical fritters, which I will also put on the UPR Zesty Garden web page if you would like to not have to run after it with a pencil while I talk. Tropical fritters, which makes about 22 of them. Take 1 1/3 cups of flour, 1 1/2 teaspoons double-acting baking powder, 3 tablespoons of sugar, 1 teaspoon of ground ginger, a dash of salt, 3/4 cup of canned chopped pineapple, which you have drained, 2 smooshed-up bananas, 1/2 cup of milk, a large egg beaten slightly, vegetable oil for deep frying, and confectioner's sugar for dusting. So in a small bowl, you just mix together the flour, baking powder, sugar, ginger, and the salt. You can sift it if you're so inclined. It doesn't need it. In another bowl, mix up the pineapple, bananas, milk, and egg, and then add the dry stuff and stir the batter until it's combined. In a pot, heat 1 1/2 inches of vegetable oil until it shimmers or reaches 375 degrees, 375 if you've got a deep fat thermometer. Drop the batter by tablespoons into the oil in batches of 6 and fry the fritters, turning them once for 1 to 1.5 minutes or until they're golden. Pick up the fritters with a slotted spoon, place on paper towels to drain, and sift the confectioner's sugar over them. I say bon appetit. That sounds like a lovely thing to do on a rainy October morning, and I'm sure we'll have more of them. So until next time, this is Nancy Williams. Don't forget to check that recipe on the Zesty Garden website at upr.org.